So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the media podcast being simulcast for one exciting week across podcast feeds at both The Guardian and themediapodcast.com, because we are coming to you this week from The Guardian's Changing Media Summit 2018. I'm Ollie Mann, and on today's show we'll discuss some of the key trends in international media with a crack team of high-powered delegates, as well as covering the big media stories of the week, as per usual, including Comcast's audacious bid for Sky TV and what the end of Leveson 2 means for Fleet Street. It's all to come on today's media podcast. And for the first part of today's show, we have located ourselves in the glamorous surroundings of the green room at the BFI South Bank. There are free marshmallow biscuits, so I'm very happy. And joining me, we welcome back the editor of The New European and Archant's chief content officer, Matt Kelly. And making her media podcast debut is the CEO and editor of The Pool, Sam Baker. Now, you're both on panels here today. Matt, you've been discussing balance and objectivity in political reporting. This is the Changing Media Summit. So what's changed?
I don't think much has changed. In fact, I think this idea that things have changed is a bit erroneous. And, you know, people often talk about how much more partisan the media is becoming and that we're all living in echo chambers. And I've been thinking about that a lot since I launched The New European. And I think it's complete nonsense. I think it's the opposite is true. I think for a start, the idea that hyper-partisan newspapers and publications are new is just nonsense. You know, you go back to the New York Post being founded by Alexander Hamilton, specifically to rubbish Thomas Jefferson, you know, or The Economist being launched specifically to repeal the Corn Laws. This is just the way that new publications arise, you know, in the heat of a particular issue or an emotion. And then the idea that we're all living in echo chambers, I think it's the reverse is true. I think we've never been exposed to more disparate viewpoints than we are today. I think 25 years ago, you had a choice where you picked your newspaper and then you listened to the news at 9 o'clock at night, which was much more fact-based than it is these days. And that was your echo chamber. These days, if you're on social media, you're exposed to an extraordinary spectrum of content. So,
okay, but then your justification for partial newspapers like yours being a news source and classified as a news source is basically it's part of a whole meal, a whole diet of news that people get. So it only works, that argument, if people are exposed to lots of other news.
Well, they are.
But we know that there are people that basically just read the Daily Mail. They exist.
Well, yeah, poor them.
Sam, I mean, do you think there is a danger with partial news, that there is an echo chamber issue, that people are just hearing their views reflected back at them?
I'm sorry, I know you want me to disagree with Matt, but I'm not going to. I just feel I agree completely, the whole echo chamber thing. The people I know who live in the most echo chamber are, you know, my parents and their friends who read the Daily Mail and only talk to people who read the Daily Mail. And so only get one point of view. But actually, because it's
Let's not just bash mail readers.
No,
there are people that just read the Mirror as well.
Because it's a newspaper, or just the Mirror, or just the Sun, or just the Telegraph,
yeah,
just the Guardian, arguably. you know, but because it's a newspaper, they think, well, it's not like that's biased. Well, of course it is. That's all newspapers have a take.
I mean, that's actually something that's quite refreshing, I think, about the New European, isn't it, Matt? Is that you've been able to go out there and say, you know, very, very staunchly and straightforwardly, this is what we think, this is what we stand for. Maybe, arguably, some of the other papers aren't as open with their biases.
Well, I talk a lot about honest partisanship and dishonest partisanship. And I think, you know, you'd have to be an absolute fool to be mistaken about what the New European stands for. And that's not necessarily the case with more mainstream newspapers. And, you know, I won't just pick on the Mail, because you could include the Mirror in this. I know, I spend a lot of time working at the Mirror, and I know that half of the Mirror's audience think it's a sort of conservative-leaning newspaper. They, you know, people don't think about media the way we in the media think about media. They're not that sophisticated about thinking about the media. Why should they be? You know, it'd be like, you know, thinking about the ins and outs of plumbing. You know, it's an abstract to them, this idea of journalism. They think about what paper sort of reflects their values, but the values are so hidden in mainstream media that it's often quite easy to think that a paper stands for something when it actually doesn't. And that's where I think it's dangerous and can be abused by editors who can sneak a message in over a long period of time on a quite pointed agenda that seeps into the national consciousness in a very dishonest, untransparent way, I would say.
And when it comes to broadcast media, Sam, do you think the rules are broadly right? Because there are some who would say the lively debate that we see in the UK news media and actually the unregulated stuff that happens online, we'd like to see a bit more of that on telly and radio. You know, it's boring having everything being impartial, especially around elections.
I think we don't give the audience credit for intelligence most of the time. I think it finds its level. We started out the poll trying to be, thinking that we had to be bipartisan, that we had to be neutral, that we shouldn't have a political bias, that we shouldn't have even a gender bias. And that soon turned out to be completely wrong. I mean, people wanted to read the women-focused content that we put out now, the women-focused news. And actually, in recent research we've done, people have said, actually, we like that it's got a point of view. We don't like being just like peddled this ostensibly straight line.
And you're very specific as well, aren't you? You're basically for busy women. That's your strap line, right? So it's female focused and it's,
well, it's for
women
people
who work.
Are kind of on the go, really. And I think the pool, I mean, I'm on a panel in a minute to talk about social media and the role that social media has played. And the pool wouldn't exist without social media, no question about it. But that's because it gave us the capacity to form. You know, we didn't have loads of money. All we had was a following in social media. So we talked to our audience, we asked them what they wanted, and then we gave it to them. People who are coming in and out and what the shape of their lives is governed by their work and their family and their device at the end of the day. So that's kind of what we mean by that.
Some of your readership is through quite the old-fashioned mechanic of email lists, though, isn't it?
Yes, and they are the most... I mean, that's one of the good things about our model is that the old-fashioned email mechanic, that audience is so loyal.
So to be clear, you send out, is it two a day?
No, we send one in the morning, so it's a news
sort of
email.
Daily briefing, basically. Something you have in common, isn't it, Matt? You're using newspapers, Sam, you're using email lists. These are models that existed
briefing.
A long time ago.
But I think people have started to understand that email, because your average email open rate is incredibly low and click-through rate, but ours is really, really high because we give them something that's useful that they consume on the way to work every day. But the pool is built like a radio program, so it's not flat like a newspaper or a magazine. It changes shape throughout the day, and we deliver content in a broadcast model throughout the day according to kind of what mood the audience is in. So it's a very user-focused model.
Okay, and what are you going to be talking about in your session then? Obviously, the political focus at the moment is on Google and Facebook and Twitter and Snapchat and whether they are platforms or whether they are publishers.
Oh, God.
That's how I feel about it.
I mean, literally, when I saw what I'd agreed to talk about, I thought, why did you do that? I mean, I feel completely torn because, like I said, we wouldn't exist without social media. It gave a business with no money the opportunity to launch. But at the same time, we're all, you know, Facebook and Google are a duopoly now. And other monopolies and duopolies get regulated. So, you know, it's difficult. And Facebook just changed its algorithm month ago, and I don't know whether I don't know how dependent you are on social media, but the first day that they started the engineering, we went from an average reach on a piece of 30,000-35,000 within an hour to two. One was the writer and one
two
was
people.
Two people. One was the writer, wow. And one was me.
And is that paid reach, or was that you putting stuff
organic,
on Facebook?
Yeah. At that point, they were trying to limit organic, but they've completely, that mellowed out within a couple of days. And, you know, now it's completely back to normal.
But we are in the situation...
Local media, just on that, at that point of algorithm change, because obviously I do the New European, but my day job is Archant, which is one of the biggest publishers of magazines and newspapers in the country. And they're local brands, and we benefited immediately from the algorithm change.
That's interesting.
Very interesting.
How?
Because... You go and ask Mark Zuckerberg. I don't know, but yeah. But whatever it was,
maybe
was
you counted
in.
As friends and family.
So I think yeah. I think there's an emphasis on identifying local community-based content, and we somehow benefited from an uplift in that. So.
I suppose you have some of those trusted local brands as well, possibly. Yeah. That you know, it's easy to say, well, that's a credible source. They've been a newspaper for 80 years.
Yeah, they've already backpedaled anyway, so it's fine.
But it is odd, isn't it, that we are all in hock to these vague decisions from people in Silicon Valley.
Well, I don't think we are, to be honest. I don't think the New European's in hock to its readers, full stop. Mm. You know, we've got 25,000 people who pay £2.50 a week, and that's the business model. And I think that's a nice business model to have. You know, providing
it's our business model too, they just don't pay.
Yes, exactly.
But
to make a serious point around that, I think businesses that are dependent on kind of digital display advertising isn't sold at a premium around that brand are in a huge amount of trouble going forward.
And the government's argument at the moment is that because the world has moved on since the first Leveson inquiry, a second one isn't necessary because of the kind of issues that you're talking about, Sam, because online, who cares whether someone 10 years ago hacked your emails? There's issues now about fake news coming out of Russia and whatever. Is that right? Is the government right to say we shouldn't be focusing on what Leveson said 5 years ago? Or is there still a case to answer there?
I think it's a really tough one. I mean, I definitely think Leveson costs a lot of money, and its focus, I do believe it's focused on restricting the freedom of the press. And the press has a lot of other problems now that are going to restrict its freedom a lot more than that. So I don't think it's a bad idea to step away from it. For sure. But
well, no, I mean, I fundamentally agree with that. I think the problem for me with Leveson is that it's looking backwards effectively at a problem that I no longer believe exists. And I think what the government should be doing, and is doing in part, to be fair, is to look forward and to say, what does media become? Because if you just isolate media as an interesting little subset of society and, you know, it's a problem in its own box, That is missing the point completely. You know, the media is literally the fabric of our communication, our society, everything. So as things fragment and change and business models change and new actors come onto the scene, the whole dynamic around media will change with it. And that, I think, is the point where we need to understand what effect will that have on kids at school and people in pubs and football fans on terraces. What will they be thinking rather than what will a bunch of barristers and senior editors and litigants be thinking in some room in the Queen Elizabeth Centre, you know?
And finally on this, Sam, I mean, as a small business, effectively, I'm sure you would not welcome more regulation. But on the other hand, if the government were to intervene to regulate the kind of content you make, what is the sort of thing they should be looking at?
Well, I was thinking about really the thoughts around regulation of Facebook. And I think it's kind of like any advertising model. Maybe it's a question that you regulate the advertiser. So, you know, all the stuff that came out yesterday about looking at political advertising on Facebook. Political advertising is regulated. So it should be regulated everywhere. So, but, you know, to regulate Facebook because you can target based on whether or not someone likes yogurt seems to me to be a bit spurious.
Oh, look who I've bumped into. It's Jim Waterson, The Guardian's new media editor. Hello, Jim.
Hello.
Congratulations on the job.
Thank you very much. It's going to be a bit different. I've been doing politics for 6 years now, but we're going to be switching over to media in April.
Here's a tricky question to ask about a new employee you haven't started working for yet. What do you suspect might be different about the way The Guardian might do things compared to BuzzFeed?
I think that they're very different. I mean, BuzzFeed, we've spent sort of 4 or 5 years, and it's been entirely about how do you make something go viral, whereas The Guardian's got the luxury, which I think is going to be more and more important, of actually having a really core readership who buy into the product and support it, and in many cases even pay for it now directly. So actually having that audience who are coming to you directly is going to be a really big change from working at somewhere like BuzzFeed.
We were actually talking about your appointment on the last edition of the Media Podcast, and our guests were saying that perhaps part of the reason behind it was that you as an individual on social media command an audience and a trust and a credibility, even though it was a different sphere, politics, now media. And actually, is there an element where you're going to slightly have to step back from your personal role and say, oh, I'm the Guardian now?
that's going to be an excellent first day conversation with the Guardian news desk to work out where the line is drawn. And if they're listening to this, then whatever you have in mind for me is completely the right decision and I will abide by it completely. I do think that there is a thing with the oddness of journalists now having sort of public personas in a way they weren't before. Previously, if I'd switched 20 years ago from The Times to The Guardian, then to be honest, the only people who'd notice would be a few PRs and a few regulars. And then readers of the new paper would slowly notice, hopefully, you know, better quality stories or something like that. But fundamentally, it wouldn't be a big deal. Whereas now journalists, I mean, I can take my Twitter followers with me to the new job and hopefully most of them will stick with me. And therefore, you've got sort of an audience for your stuff that you can, to a certain extent, self-promote and get people to actually read your stuff regardless of where you're working and hopefully funnel them now in the new job towards The Guardian.
OK, what have you spotted coming up at today's summit that you are actually excited to hear?
Well, the one I'm really intrigued by is Martin Sorrell, because he has got a very tricky job at the moment trying to balance this enormous media conglomerate where there's, you know, talking to some of the new startups around who are trying to completely cut people like WPP and all their agencies out of the equation by giving people the ability to buy all their ads on Facebook directly, by giving them ability to automate all the processes that currently are fed through a nice manager who takes his 10% cut. His justification for where he's taking the company is going to be very interesting.
And also, I guess, his reaction to the new competition that's out there that just doesn't require an operation that large.
Yeah, and as someone who enjoys people in the media industry and thinks it's good to have sort of jobs based in the UK, it is worrying that basically everything seems to be flowing through California at the moment. That said, I mean, you go to Facebook's HQ and they seem to be taking over half of London every time they've built a new building. They've got another one is being put up.
You're going to get offered a lot of free lunches now, aren't you, from Facebook and Google? You've got to be careful of their buffets.
All joking apart, I think that is a real problem. You've got a lot of very, very powerful people all working for two or three companies. Previously, if you're covering the media, you'd have the indie production houses who could have as much power as some of the broadcasters. And certainly for about the last 20 years, you've had all these channels where you've been able to get your stuff put out there. Now everything's so focused that how you report on Facebook and Twitter is going to be a key part of the job and hopefully one that I'll be on the right side of.
Don't turn down the buffet there, because it is really good. I've been.
Oh, I mean, I do love a good buffet. I mean, I'm not that pure.
Now, in your tweet announcing your move from BuzzFeed to The Guardian, you actually said that media reporting these days is a bit like political reporting. Perhaps never more so than when covering what's going on at Sky at the moment, and Murdoch and Disney and all of the shenanigans that are happening around that. What's your take on the big news this week, which is that Comcast are looking to buy Sky from right under Murdoch's nose?
As a hack who likes a good bit of colour, I can't get my head past the wonderful line put out by the Comcast boss that he decided it after getting a cab around London and being impressed by the cabbie's knowledge of the Sky box. Now, I don't care if that's absolute rubbish. It's such a good tale. But I think the thing that's interesting from my new beat is what that means for Sky News. And the people I've sort of been talking to there have seems to be quite pro-Comcast, I'd say, almost, that they're very worried about Disney coming in and what Disney will actually feel about, despite all the reassurances, what Disney will feel about maintaining what is essentially a loss-making channel that Rupert Murdoch originally set up largely to gain influence with politicians, and why that would be needed under the new regime. And the noises I'm hearing from Comcast, who obviously have substantial news operations already, that Sky people would be quite amenable to that.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting, isn't it? We went a few weeks ago from discussing whether people taking jobs at Sky News now should feel safe, to actually there being almost a race to promise them ever longer careers. You've got Murdoch and Disney and NBC now all saying, yeah, we'll put more money into Sky News, it'll be fine.
I wouldn't be too worried if I was a Sky News employee. I mean, the RTSs, they were winning awards the other week. I think they're in a really good place. I think that their online offering is getting much better. So I wouldn't be too worried, and it would be a very, very bold purchaser who chose to shut them down. Mainly because a lot of MPs like going on it, and you wouldn't want to take them on and take them off air.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Joining us for her media podcast debut, this is very exciting. She's great. I've met her in real life. It's Nikki Birch, founder of Rosina Sound. Hello, Nikki Birch.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Welcome to the show. Now, you basically now work with smart audio, right? That's your thing.
Yeah, I do that and podcasts as well.
So, but the difference being, because we met when you were just a humble audio producer making radio shows and podcasts, but now it's about voice-activated devices. So this is Echo and HomePod and Google Home.
Yeah, so I'm looking at exploring what formats you can do, it's sort of taking audio beyond just the linear form, so it's interactive. And it's a really exciting opportunity for audio producers, and that's what we're here to talk about at the conference as well, so it's brilliant.
And also here to talk about it with you is Jason Phipps, head of audio at The Guardian. I've heard of it. Jason, do you agree that this is an exciting moment? Or do you think, oh, is it just more devices we have to format our content for? It's fine, they're just MP3s.
Yeah, I think it's exciting and terrifying in equal measure. I think it's a real kind of shift in the nature of what we do. I think it goes beyond the MP3 and just staring at a microphone as I am now. I think it's really about a new emerging kind of audio web, like the internet of voice. And I think it's also about people pivoting away from visual interactions into audio voice interactions. So I think it couldn't be more momentous. I really think that, but I mean, obviously I'm in my bubble, it's an audio bubble, but it feels that way. It very much feels that way.
Let's talk about some actual real world examples though of what this could mean, because there's a lot of corporate buzz speak about this. What's an interactive audio show that can use smart voice?
Okay, so there's a number of different examples. You have a really basic linear form, which is listening to the radio on a voice device, but you have instructions through voice, what song's playing, turn that over to another station, who's on, so pause, rewind, skip, things like that, which are really, really useful tools and have already been shown to kind of have huge take-up in terms of radio listenership. I think the BBC Skill, launched in late December, has 1 million unique users already. I mean, that's quite impressive. It's already their highest, biggest digital platform for listening to radio, and it's only 3 months old. So, you know, it is a really huge kind of change. And once you get beyond that, it's looking at voice-first formats, so not just kind of transporting what radio and podcasts do or into voice. It's thinking, okay, well, now we can interact, whether it's talking to a live presenter or whether it's actually having content that you can move and direct yourself around. From an advertising perspective, it's obviously really interesting because it's got potential click-throughs, effectively, to purchase. It's got feedback for audiences, direct feedback. It's a really unknown and interesting area. And one thing I'd like to add in terms of creatively, you know, that who knows what we're going to do? It's really interesting. And from a creative perspective, it's audio producers are really, you know, in a new position because they can be thinking, we have the skills already in terms of delivering content from an audio perspective, but we also have to learn digital skills. And that's thinking about user experience and design and things like that, which perhaps audio producers haven't done before. So it's a big learning curve and it's a big learning opportunity. It's very exciting.
You know, I hadn't thought about the feedback thing before, but now, you know, as a former LBC phone-in host, it's actually quite an appealing idea, isn't it? This concept of people shouting at the radios. They can now literally say, call him. And from their kitchen, whilst drinking their wine, they can be on the radio.
Yeah, I think that basic text interaction, I think that happens with live radio will change radically. But like, I think it's one of those who knows that fills me with excitement and not dread, really, because it offers so many interesting tools and iterations. But it's also a very different thing. We're rounding everything into one sort of, you know, audio market. Smart speakers will serve this market. I don't think so. I think it will have a really interesting proposition for linear, and then it will have a very different but interesting proposition for podcasts, which is effectively the on-demand end of the kind of linear proposition. And then it will have a totally different outcome in terms of just basic audio interactions and tools. Like, at the moment, we haven't even seen any kind of business breakout, and I know there are corporate tools around that are going to be built around this. I know Amazon has ambitions specifically. I'm sure Google has ambitions. So there's just like worlds that hasn't yet been mapped, but you can't ignore it. I mean, that's the whole session today. You can't ignore it. You have to sort of confront it. I mean, simple things, which everybody used to think, oh, my company brand sounds like this. We've got a sandal, or we've got, like, you know, it's a swoosh at the beginning of the opening of a machine. But now you'll have to have an unbelievably complex and worked out idea of what your brand or what your product or what you sound like, who you and not only that, nuanced one where, you know, are you going to sound different to someone in the States, or, you know, you have to have a global one and a national one. All of those things haven't really been worked out, but they're running through people's minds at a frantic rate at the moment.
And are they running through the minds, do we think, of people in Silicon Valley? Or do they not massively care about podcasts and radio, really? Because it's all very well saying, if you work in the industry, or this is great, it's a great challenge. Fact is, if I say to my HomePod at home, hey Siri, state one of your shows, Jason, hey Siri, play me the latest episode of Football Weekly, it will play it. But if I say, play me the episode of Football Weekly from 2 weeks ago, it doesn't understand what I'm saying. And that is so basic that it seems like there's steps behind what it needs to be.
Yeah, but we're at that point where we were in, like, in the internet with sort of basic, you know, sort of HTML pages and clunky links and no formatting. And also, I think what Nikki said is right, which is it's also a kind of linguistic challenge. I think the challenge will go beyond people in the audio, in journalism or in content creation. I think it'll involve, you know, technologists, linguists, content creators. It's a massive challenge. We're building essentially a kind of an internet of voice. And so, think of all the issues that had to be resolved over the last 20 years and just creating some crappy apps that we have on our phone now. You know, even the best ones are not even great, and you think of that that mountain to climb. We're really at the foothills at the moment.
Yeah, I would also say it's beyond audio. It will, I mean, to use a really overused phrase, disrupt television too. And I think that's something we'll see next year. We're like, oh, okay, this has a much bigger impact than just audio producers, because you will be able to interact with TV just in the way that you can interact with voice now. So I think it's a bit broader and wider, so it's kind of the utilities around our house, the utilities in terms of our phone and our access to our personal computer, but it also is our entertainment devices across all mediums. And I think Google particularly are hammering home what they call multimodal, which is, you know, screens, audio, everything working together in terms of voice. So I think it's going to we are perhaps in a good position as audio producers because we are at the forefront of this, but it will be much more kind of prolific across all media.
And also, just to circle back to your question, which I think was a really, really good one, which is, do you think that the companies that have created these kind of devices understand the nature of what they've done? I actually don't think they entirely do. I think it's always, in retrospect, we think back, we think, yeah, Steve Jobs, he must have known all of this. And I think, no, I think there's a kind of driver for devices and for various kinds of technologies. And then suddenly the consequences unfold. And I think the consequences of these devices and these tools will be more profound than anyone sort of figures out at the moment. And I really know that, not to name names, but I've sat down with a couple of the big platforms and they can tangibly sense that they're not sure exactly what they've just created. It's you can feel that in the room. Yeah. And that's exciting.
I would agree. They didn't necessarily create an entertainment device. They created a utility device, a command and control device where I could order pizza, I could order a taxi, I could do, that's what it was built to do. And now it's being already used in much more broader uses, which is fantastic for the platforms. They're happy about that, but they're having to kind of play catch up in how they deliver that content.
Well, it hasn't taken long, and we find ourselves in the bar. I've just been joined by media writer Jane Martinson. Welcome back to the show, Jane.
Thank you for having me.
And also former ad exec Cindy Gallup. Now, you've got your session coming up, Cindy.
Jane, that's right.
Just done one. What were you talking about?
We're talking about platforms and publishers, really, although during the course of the panel, we discussed the fact that actually the term platform is a bit ridiculous in a world in which the distinction is becoming so blurred. So it was really about the news ecosystem, how it's broken and what we can do about it.
What did we learn?
Well, I think what we learned is that there is a real mood towards regulation, towards governments trying to take more responsibility. I think the news industry, who recognise how brilliant social media and online platforms have been for their own business, have also realised that they've sort of, you know, let in the Trojan horse and now are trying to work out what to do about it before they're all burnt to the ground. So there's a move towards trying to work something out. We had Madhav Chinappi from Google on the panel along with Damian Collins, obviously the MP. And I think Madhav was saying, you know, it's really complicated. We all know it's complicated. I think as long as we're trying to work out a solution, interestingly, there was no one from Facebook, you know, out of its 24,000 plus employees, no one at all from Facebook could come onto the panel and discuss what Facebook are doing about it.
On that, I don't know if you saw Hugo Rifkin's piece in the Saturday Times magazine this weekend, but he was essentially, I mean, it was a kind of funny piece about the slight redundancy of these kind of talking shops, but he was saying Facebook basically don't care what we do in Britain or indeed Europe. It only matters what happens in California and therefore America.
Well, actually, what's really interesting about that, and I agree, but I would say they increasingly behave, and Facebook and lots of these supranational groups behave as if not that they just don't care what's happening in the UK, but they don't care what's happening in California. They don't care what's happening with elected officials, because supranational organisations act on a global basis. And what you do as a politician, as an elected politician, is sort of they give the impression they think it's small beer. I mean, I don't know if you listened to the panel in which obviously the UK Select Committee went out to Washington and had Facebook, Twitter, and Google give evidence. And Damien was saying that, you know, they came across a situation where Facebook said they'd been paid for, they'd found out they'd been paid for US political advertising with rubles. And when the political leadership asked why they hadn't done anything about it, they sort of gave the impression of, well, we didn't know we had to. You know, it's money, why should we?
And actually, and then sort that of does contrary in British law, doesn't it?
But you think about political advertising, not just British money. Law, political advertising typically, and, you know, all advertising executives, Cindy will know lots about this as well, that, you know, there are strong laws about political advertising around the world because obviously, you know, bias and rigging elections and ad fraud is not just an issue in terms of the industry, the economy, but in terms of politics, that's a whole other ball game. So, of course, it matters. And, you know, to be a super national organisation that doesn't care about it, that cannot be sustainable.
And, Cindy, this is where it's not just about the news ecosystem, as Jane put it. It's actually about advertising as well, isn't it?
No, you're absolutely right. And, in fact, in my talk, I'm going to be addressing what lies at the absolute heart of all of the issues that have been debated on stage today. So I've found this morning fascinating.
Which is?
So I am speaking about responsibility in advertising. Do we have any, and what is it? And I am giving, as I'll be announcing right up front, a highly subjective talk, because I believe we absolutely do. I believe we have three specific areas of responsibility in the ad industry, and I'm going to speak to each of those. And the very first one, and I fully anticipate, by the way, when I put this slide up, people are going to be, you know, thinking, what is she on? Our first responsibility as the advertising industry is to redesign the future of technology. And I know that sounds ludicrously big, and probably a lot of people are going to think, why the hell is that our responsibility? And the reason for that is, and I will be presenting some quotes and anecdotes to illustrate this, the founders of the gigantic tech platforms that dominate the future of our industry have one thing in common. They all absolutely bloody hate advertising. It's very ironic. Larry and Sergey, when they started Google, said, we will never run advertising on Google. And yet today, 95% of Google's revenue comes from advertising. David Karp of Tumblr famously announced how much he despised advertising, had to backpedal rapidly when Yahoo bought Tumblr, and then went, but we want to monetize brand partnerships. Jan Koum, the co-founder of WhatsApp, when Facebook bought WhatsApp for $17 billion a couple of years ago, went, I promise you, ads will never interrupt you. So here's the issue. When you absolutely bloody hate advertising, and yet it is a necessary evil because your huge rounds of funding, gigantic valuations, and humongous IPOs are all predicated on advertising, on your investors and Wall Street's belief that you'll be able to monetize those millions of eyeballs through us, essentially, and yet you absolutely despise it, you will never, ever leverage the extraordinary power of technology to actually create the future advertising in very interesting ways. And in fact, secondly, you will do the exact opposite. And that is what has driven everything that's been complained about and discussed on the stage this morning. And so we have a responsibility to completely redesign that. And I'm going to tell our industry how.
That's from an ad exec's point of view. What if actually the way to redesign the industry is to go back to founding principles? Advertising isn't a necessary evil. We made a mistake having it, and we should have just charged subscribers.
Actually, that's never going to happen. And so I'm addressing a very real barrier.
Should it have happened 10 years ago?
But there is another underlying reason why we are debating what we're debating today. And that is that the founders of every single one of these tech platforms exemplify what is true of our industry, which is that they are a closed loop of white guys talking to white guys about other white guys. So as I was listening to your discussion, your panel, Jane, it's really fascinating because I was thinking, when I concepted my own tech startup, Make Love Not Porn, which is the world's first social sex video sharing platform, you know, celebrating real world sex as a counterpoint to porn.
Amazingly succinct summary and great use of the word concepted, may I
right,
say.
Right, thank you. Here's what I and my predominantly female team did back in 2011, you know, when we spent literally 2 years designing Make Love Not Porn. We sat down and we asked ourselves, as we build what is essentially a social sex tech platform, what are the worst case scenarios that could possibly happen? And we designed them out. Literally, we thought, we knew we were going to invite people to do something they've never done before, socially share their real world sex. We thought through every possible ramification of that to create a completely safe and trustworthy space. And that was through the female lens, which has been signally missing in the design of all of these platforms and the operation. And the reason that's a problem is because white men are the least harassed and abused group on the internet. Women and people of colour know abuse, know harassment, and when we create ventures, we design it out. We take account of it. We go, how can we prevent this? And we design it out. We're aware of it. Okay. And so, you know, when you have a massively white male-dominated tech world with a white male-dominated tech platforms, everything that we are, again, debating and discussing on the stage, I guarantee you would not be issues in the same way if there were gender-equal and diverse teams designing and running and operating those platforms.
Okay, I think at that point we do have to wrap up because the mini hamburgers are making their way around the room. That is it from our show for today. My thanks to Jane Martinson, Cindy Gallup, Matt Kelly, Sam Baker, Jim Waterson, Nikki Birch and Jason Phipps. And thank you also to The Guardian. It's lovely to be back. If you are new to the show, did you know that you can get new episodes as soon as they're released by subscribing for free at our website, themediapodcast.com? And if you've been with us for a while and you value what we do, you can help secure our future by taking out a voluntary subscription. Just a fiver a month can keep us going in the months, maybe years, to come. Head to themediapodcast.com/donate and give generously. I'm Ollie Mann, the producer Matt Hill, and The Media Podcast is a PPM production. Until next time, bye-bye.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.